Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into a truly groundbreaking initiative. Our mission: to unpack tackling a disease on a global scale, the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, GP2, a new generation of opportunities. This paper, co-authored by Cornelis Bloendrot, Alistair J. Noyce, Ignacio F. Mata, and the entire Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, published in 2025 in the American Journal of Human Genetics. Well, it's critically important. It really shines a spotlight on the urgent need for diversity in genetics research, especially for a complex, debilitating disease like Parkinson's. And this isn't just about equity, you know. It's a profound scientific imperative. It unlocks entirely new insights and therapeutic possibilities for everyone.
Absolutely. And what's really compelling here is that GP2 isn't just pointing out the problem. It's actually presenting a comprehensive, actionable roadmap. This program is intentionally moving beyond the sort of traditional limitations, the isolated research efforts, to forge something pretty unprecedented.
Like what exactly?
Well, a global, collaborative, and importantly, sustainable research collective. It's really designed to usher in a whole new generation of opportunities for understanding Parkinson's disease.
Okay, so we should probably dig into how they're actually building this future then.
Definitely.
To fully grasp the, let's say, revolution GP2 represents, we first need to understand the challenge it's tackling, Parkinson's disease itself. Clinically, Parkinson's has traditionally been defined by things you see after death, right?
Mm-hmm.
Neuropathological changes like Lewy bodies and nigrostriatal degeneration.
Yeah, the Queen Square Brain Bank criteria really operationalized that. For diagnosing living individuals, the MGS, that's the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society, uses a kind of two-stage approach.
Okay, what's stage one?
First, you recognize the Parkinsonism, the core motor symptoms, that's bradykinesia, so slowness of movement, rigidity, or tremor.
And stage two.
Then you determine the probability of it being PD based on other supportive clinical criteria.
Got it. But it's not a simple, uniform condition, is it?
Not at all. A crucial aspect to grasp is the sheer heterogeneity, the clinical signs, the progression. It varies wildly from person to person.
Which must make diagnosis and prognosis really tricky.
Exactly. And if you look long term, well, a composite analysis showed that 8 years after diagnosis, about 8% of people with PD have died.
Wow.
Yeah. And around 25% have significant balance problems. And another 25% develop cognitive impairment or even dementia. It's a formidable opponent.
And the global burden is increasing alarmingly. That's not just a statistic, is it? It feels like a real call to action.
It really is. We've seen a striking 60.7% increase in PD prevalence, mortality, and disability just between 1990 and 2021.
60%? That's huge. How does that compare to other neurodegenerative diseases?
We'll put it this way. Alzheimer's saw about a 3.2% increase in the same period.
Okay, that really puts it into perspective.
And this increase is particularly noticeable in low to middle income countries. Researchers are actively looking into why. Could it be environmental factors like pesticides, air pollution?
Or maybe lifestyle changes, other health conditions, or maybe we're just getting better at diagnosing it in those regions.
All possibilities. It's complex. And interestingly, men tend to be affected more often, though even that has regional variations.
So, given all this clinical complexity, how's our actual biological understanding of Parkinson's changing? Is the definition itself evolving?
It absolutely is. We're shifting from a purely clinical diagnosis towards a more biological one, and that's largely thanks to advances in biomarkers.
Like the alpha-synuclein assays.
Exactly. The alpha-synuclein seed amplification assay, the SNSAA, that's become a key biomarker. It can help differentiate PD based on its underlying pathology, the presence of misfolded alpha-synuclein.
But I hear there are caveats.
Oh, definitely. We have to be careful interpreting these. About 5% to 15% of people clinically diagnosed with PD actually test negative on this assay.
Which suggests?
It suggests they might have a form of Parkinsonism that doesn't involve Lewy bodies, maybe a different underlying pathology altogether.
And what about the other way around? Healthy people testing positive.
That happens too. Around 5% to 10% of healthy individuals can test positive, and it seems to increase with age. So it highlights the complexity and the need for even more precise tools.
So what does this shift towards biology mean for research and for treatment development?
It has big implications. This pathological diversity, it actually reduces the statistical power in big studies like GDOMEA's genome-wide association studies.
Right, because you're not comparing apples to apples if the underlying biology differs within your PD group.
Precisely. It makes it harder to find true genetic associations. You need much larger, more diverse data sets to cut through that noise. Same goes for clinical trials, especially those targeting alpha-synuclein.
So defining TD by its biology, even if it doesn't change immediate patient care today, is fundamental for future progress.
It's absolutely crucial. It's the step towards precision or stratified medicine, understanding the specific disease mechanisms in different patient groups. We need to know what we're fighting.
Okay, so Parkinson's isn't monolithic. It's diverse, it's evolving, and its global nature demands a different kind of research strategy.
You bet it.
With that clinical picture clear, let's switch focus to the genetics. Because there has been remarkable progress over the last, what, 3 decades?
Oh, absolutely. Huge strides. We've identified over a dozen genes that carry high-risk mutations, ones that significantly increase the chances of developing PD or directly cause it.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. You have genes like LRRK2, SNCA, RB32, VPS35 mutations. They are typically autosomal dominant, meaning you only need one faulty copy.
And recessive ones.
Right. Then there are autosomal recessive genes like PRKN, PNK1, PRK7. For those, you generally need faulty copies from both parents for the disease to manifest.
And this next point really underscores the complexity, doesn't it? That these mutations don't just cause Parkinson's, they lead to varied forms of the disease.
Exactly. Clinically and sometimes even pathologically variable. For instance, people with certain LRRK2 or VPS35 variants often have slower progression, maybe variable amounts of Lewy body pathology.
But others are different.
Yeah, contrast that with SNCA variants. They're often linked to more rapid progression, earlier onset, and usually consistent Lewy body pathology.
Which again highlights why we can't treat all Parkinson's the same, even when we know the specific gene mutation involved. It really complicates designing effective therapies, I imagine.
It absolutely does. That nuance is vital. And it's not just these high penetrance genes. We've also found moderate risk variants.
Like in LRRK2 again?
Yes. LRRK2 has variants like PGlar23-85ARG and PARG1628PRO. They're relatively common in Asian populations and roughly double the risk of PD.
And GBA1's another big one, right? Linked to Gaucher disease.
That's right. Mutations in GBA1 cause Gaucher disease when you inherit two copies. But even having just one copy, being a carrier, significantly increases PD risk. And often, it leads to faster progression and a higher chance of dementia in those individuals with PD.
So we have high-risk genes, moderate-risk variants. Yeah. What else contributes?
Well, moving beyond specific genes, large genome-wide studies, the GEAS approach, have identified over 100 common genetic variants linked to PD risk.
Ah, the common disease, common variant idea.
Exactly. The thinking is that much of the genetic risk for common diseases like PD comes from many common variants, each having just a small individual effect, but they add up. It paints a picture of a very complex genetic tapestry.
And there's this fascinating concept of pleomorphic risk loci. What's that about?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It means that a single gene like SNCA, LRRK2, VPS13C, or GBA1 can actually harbor a whole spectrum of variants, high-risk ones, medium-risk ones, and low-risk common ones identified by GWAS.
So the same gene can be implicated in different ways.
Precisely. It suggests a kind of mechanistic continuum within that gene's function related to the disease. It's a profound insight because it tells us a gene can be centrally important to the disease process, even if the common variants found through GWAS only have a small effect size.
That definitely shifts how you might think about therapeutic targets.
It really does.
But despite all this incredible progress, there's a major gap, isn't there? A huge bias in the research population.
There is. A critical, glaring gap. Almost all of this complex genetic work, especially the large GWS studies, has been done primarily in populations of Northern European ancestry.
And you mentioned this isn't just an equity issue, it's a scientific problem. Why?
Because expanding discovery into underrepresented populations, URPs, isn't just the right thing to do, it offers massive scientific advantages. Mm. Different populations have different genetic histories, different frequencies of variants.
How does that help?
Well, it allows us to potentially fine map existing risk regions with much greater precision. It can help us nominate completely novel risk factors that might be rare or absent in European populations. And it gives us a broader, richer understanding of the disease biology overall. We're missing pieces of the puzzle by only looking in one place.
It's a scientific necessity, basically.
Absolutely.
And there's a powerful example of this already, isn't there? With the GBA1 gene in African ancestry individuals.
Yes, exactly. A recent study identified a non-coding risk factor, RS311-5534G, specifically in individuals of African ancestry.
And the follow-up was quick.
Incredibly quick. They rapidly figured out the mechanism it causes a reduction in the GBA1 protein because of missplicing. And bam, that immediately opened up new possibilities for GBA1 targeted clinical trials, specifically tailored for this population with that variant.
That really shows the direct translational impact of diversifying research.
It's a perfect example.
So zooming out a bit, what's the ultimate point of all this genetic discovery? What do we do with this information?
Well, it serves multiple purposes. One major area is disease risk prediction. There's growing interest in using genetic info, like polygenic risk scores.
Combining the effects of many small risk variants.
Exactly. The idea is to integrate that with other risk factors, clinical and environmental, to create multimodal predictors. These could potentially identify people at high risk years before symptoms start, maybe help classify subtypes of PD based on mechanism, or even match patients to the most suitable therapies down the line.
And beyond prediction, the genetics offer direct biological clues, right?
Absolutely critical. Genetic risk factors give us a direct window into the disease pathways. They point us towards the biological processes that go wrong. Take TMM175 variants, for instance.
Okay, what do they reveal?
Finding those variants spurred research showing they impair lysosomal function, the cell's recycling system, and that affects how alpha-synuclein builds up. So identifying the gene immediately pointed towards lysosomes as a potential therapeutic target.
It guides the downstream research.
Precisely. It tells you where to look.
You also mentioned a common fallacy about effect size, that a small genetic effect doesn't mean the gene isn't important.
Right. People often think, oh, this GWAS variant only increases risk by 10%, so the gene can't be that important. But that's flawed logic. As we discussed with cleomorphic risk loci, a gene can be absolutely central, harboring rare high-impact mutations and common low-impact variants.
So the statistical significance, the confidence that the gene is involved, is more important for target identification than the size of the effect of any single common variant.
Exactly. The p-value, the confidence level from the genetic study, tells you the finding is real. That's what matters for saying, okay, this genetic pathway is involved, let's investigate it for therapies.
And does the evidence back this up in terms of drug development?
It does, quite strongly. Empirical evidence shows that therapeutic approaches backed by genetic evidence are 2 to 3 times more likely to succeed in clinical trials.
Wow, 2 to 3 times.
Yep. And interestingly, that holds true regardless of whether the initial genetic evidence came from a rare, high-impact variant or a common, low-impact one. Genetic validation significantly boosts the odds of success.
That's a powerful motivator for this kind of research.
Definitely.
And it's not just about risk of getting PD, is it? Genetics might also influence how the disease progresses.
That's a really exciting emerging area. Researchers are now looking at the genetic basis of other features. Age at onset, the speed of progression, comorbidities like dementia.
Is there overlap with the risk genes?
Sometimes. GBA1, for example, influences both risk and progression speed. But progression studies are also finding new variants, ones not linked to initial PD risk, in genes like APOE, LRP1, RIMS2, and others.
Which could open up entirely different therapeutic avenues.
Potentially, yes. Maybe gene therapies targeting progression specifically. It's still early days, though. These findings need large-scale replication, but it's a very promising direction.
Okay, so this brings us squarely to the solution designed to tackle all these challenges, the scale, the diversity, the complexity. Tell us about GP2.
Right, GP2, the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, it's a major international initiative launched back in 2020.
And its mission?
Its mission is ambitious, to dramatically expand our understanding of the genetic basis of PD and related disorders, things like MSA, Lewy body dementia, PSP, even prodromal PD, but crucially, doing it in a truly global context.
So it acts as a kind of coordinating body.
Exactly. Think of it as a global hub. It facilitates everything from recruiting participants and collecting samples to generating high-quality genetic data, making sure that data is harmonized and can be shared effectively, and ultimately driving the discovery of new therapeutic targets.
And what are its core principles?
It's built on foundational tenets like transparency, democratizing access to data and discovery tools, providing robust training and career support, focusing on actionable results, and really fostering a functional, collaborative collective of researchers worldwide. It's a strategic framework.
The scale sounds immense. How many groups are involved?
It's genuinely impressive. As of May 2025, GP2 was working with 275 research groups across the globe.
Wow.
And they had data and samples committed from about 265,000 individuals. The governance is also multi-layered, with a main steering committee and various working groups focused on specific areas: complex disease genetics, a monogenic disease, underrepresented populations, equity, training, data sharing, operations, compliance. It ensures broad input and expertise.
So how does it work in practice? What are the key action areas? The paper mentions four.
That's right. Figure two in the paper lays them out nicely. First is global collaboration and capacity building. They have over 400 members from more than 200 sites in over 60 countries. They run communication hubs and hold regular in-person meetings, like the big annual meeting in Copenhagen in 2023, and regional meetings in places like Cartagena, Kuala Lumpur, and Casablanca in 2024. It's about building real connections.
Okay, what's the second area?
Second is applying transformative genetic methods. They use centralized data production, genotyping, sequencing done at scale. This approach brings huge benefits in terms of cost efficiency, but also, crucially, standardization and harmonization. Everyone's data is generated and processed consistently.
Makes sense. Third.
Third, and this is so important for the future, is growing the next generation of leaders. They have a large trainee network, over 250 members. They've directly funded PhDs and master's students, 13 PhDs and 12 masters so far.
That's significant investment.
It is. Plus, they offer a huge library of over 70 online courses translated into nearly 100 languages, covering everything from basic genetics to complex analysis. And they run Training the Trainer workshops globally. Mexico, Colombia, Kyrgyzstan, India, Malaysia, empowering local researchers to become mentors themselves.
Really building capacity from the ground up. And the fourth area.
Fourth is accelerating discovery by democratizing data. This is key. They've built a cloud-based data platform. This allows for standardized analysis pipelines and makes collaboration much easier.
And GP2 covers the computing costs.
Yes. For approved research projects, GP2 covers the computational costs, removing a major barrier for many researchers, especially in lower resource settings. There's a project proposal working group that reviews proposals to ensure equity, transparency, scientific quality, and they operate with a no surprises policy regarding data use.
How many projects are running on this platform?
Currently, they have about 60 active project proposals involving over 50 investigators from 42 different countries. It really opens up access to cutting-edge research for a much wider community.
And they're also investing in physical infrastructure. You mentioned biorepositories.
That's right. Direct, tangible support. They helped fund the construction of a biorepository in Lima, Peru, and there are plans for another one in Lagos, Nigeria. This kind of investment builds lasting local research capability.
So 5 years in, what's the output been like? Are we seeing results?
Definitely. They're doing regular data releases, clinical and genetic data, roughly 3 times a year. Around 83,000 individuals' data is already available through their platform.
And published findings.
Yes, they've published initial proof of principle results. That includes a large multi-ancestry GDBUS and that specific African ancestry GDBUS locus in GB1 we talked about earlier, the one with the rapid translational follow-up.
So the model is working. What's the outlook?
The outlook is very positive. They anticipate identifying over 50 new PD risk variants and several new causal genes in the next few years, really demonstrating the power of this global collaborative approach.
Okay, so reflecting on these first 5 years, what are the big takeaways, the key lessons learned from trying to build something on this scale?
Well, one absolutely crucial lesson is the need for stable, flexible funding. The long-term support from groups like the ASAP Initiative, the Sergey Brin Family Foundation, and the Michael J. Fox Foundation has been absolutely essential. It allowed GP2 to set an ambitious vision and adapt as the science evolved.
That makes sense. Big science needs stable backing. What about the operational side? Balancing centralized efficiency with decentralized needs.
That's a constant balancing act and a really important one. They've found huge value in centralizing things like data production for standardization and cost effectiveness. But they're also continually working to empower investigators locally, pushing data access, analysis tools, and training out to partners worldwide as their own capabilities grow. It's about enabling equity.
And I guess setting up this kind of global network takes a lot of time and effort behind the scenes.
Oh, absolutely. It's not trivial. The paper notes the initial structure took over a year just to establish, and maintaining it requires significant ongoing operational investment. Building trust is also paramount, especially when working with historically underrepresented groups.
How do they build that trust?
Through direct and indirect support. They support over 80 URP investigators with resources, technical help, and importantly, by holding those regional meetings to really listen to local needs and challenges, maybe adapting assessment tools, providing specific analysis workshops, or funding sabbaticals to foster collaboration.
And finding and empowering local champions seems key too.
Totally. Ensuring international representation at all levels of GP2's structure is vital. And providing real, long-term training and leadership opportunities for talented people at all career stages, including funding those studentships we mentioned, helps build a diverse pipeline of future leaders in PD genetics globally.
Any other major lessons?
I think the commitment to flexibility and self-evaluation stands out. Science changes, new challenges arise. GP2 seems committed to trying new things, admitting when something isn't working, and changing course based on feedback and new knowledge. For example, they're now exploring complex issues like how to return genetic results ethically across different cultural contexts and partnering with clinical testing initiatives like PD Generation.
So it's not just about the immediate genetic discoveries. The broader impact is building this sustainable, equitable, global capacity.
Exactly. It's about supporting researchers to get their own independent grants, fostering collaborations within regions, especially in the global south. It's creating a foundation for long-term scientific growth and equity that will hopefully last well beyond GP2 itself. It's a really visionary model.
Okay, let's try to wrap this up. It seems clear that genetic insights are becoming absolutely critical for really understanding Parkinson's disease, refining how we classify it, hopefully diagnosing it earlier, and ultimately paving the way for more targeted, maybe even personalized therapies.
Couldn't agree more. And what this GP2 work powerfully demonstrates is that truly understanding a complex global disease like PD requires a global approach. We need that diversity. It's not just about equity. It provides invaluable scientific insights we simply cannot get by studying isolated populations.
So GP2 really stands out as this vital global collective. It's tackling that need for diversity head on, leveraging the opportunities it creates, coordinating science on an unprecedented scale, and crucially, empowering a whole new generation of investigators worldwide.
It's setting a new standard for how collaborative science can be done.
Definitely. So maybe a final thought for you, our listeners, to ponder. Given GP2's success in uncovering these hidden genetic insights by looking globally, what novel disease mechanisms or perhaps completely new therapeutic avenues might lie undiscovered right now, waiting in the unique genetic landscapes of your own communities, ready to be revealed if we apply similar collaborative, equitable efforts?